meeting, agenda item 9, status report on climate change adaptation workshop.
Yes, I'm going to have Mr. Smith give a presentation, but I just want to set a little bit of context of how we got to this day, and why we have this, why we're doing what we need to do. It was just a mere, not too long ago, 10-ish years ago, in 2005, that California was the first state, actually on the planet, that made the recommendations that climate change is indeed real, and that we need to do something about it. And that we identified the state of California, the five main sources of climate change gases that we needed to address. And they are energy, transportation, the manufacturing sector, landfills, and cement kilns. Based on that report, quantifying how many tons, California passed the law 8032 to regulate those sources of greenhouse gases. And at the same time, started this whole new concept of adaptation. How do we deal with the results of these greenhouse gases in our state? I've worked on many public policy areas over my career, and I've never seen one move so rapidly in terms of problem to let's do something about it than this one. The Clean Water Act was in the 60s. The air pollution laws started in the 40s and 50s. All the hazardous waste laws were in the 80s. This one really has moved at an exponential rate. I think all of us, because I was involved in that legislation back then, thought that we could worry about adaptation down the road. That was something we could figure out a little bit later. We need to work on the sources. Little did we know, the adaptation is now on our doorstep much faster, I think, than anyone anticipated, and not just California, but the rest of the states and around the planet are dealing with the effects, the climate change impacts, and are scrambling to try to work on those issues. Many state agencies were created for other purposes, building roads for Caltrans, many agencies, building standards, ourselves, the Air Board, CalRecycle. We all found ourselves having to re-examine our core base of our structure, of what we did and why we did it. And we needed to change and adapt ourselves, our structures and tools to get to a different place. It is because of that, and we're seeing the effects in our region already. You all dealt with the fire waiver in the Round area near Mammoth on Fire that happened when traditionally you don't see fires in the winter. This is our future, and this is why we staff, I mean, this board takes to heart, and the state board as well, that we need to really closely examine this issue of climate change. Both our tools. The hard part is we have tools. You'll hear about those. But the big question also is, what are the tools we don't have that we should have to deal with this issue? So that's just my overarching comments. I'm going to hand it now to Mr. Smith to walk you through the item and what we're going to discuss.
Thank you, Ms. Kuyumje. Good morning, Vice Chair, board members, and everybody else in attendance. I'm Doug Smith, a supervising a geologist and a division manager in the South Lake Tahoe office in charge of the Planning and Restoration Division, and I'm really happy to be here to present this item. Now, before I launch into the presentation, I want to mention that there's a late edition that you should have received. I think Sue sent that around to you. And there's copies in the back. It's Enclosure 5, which is an 11 by 17 of this conceptual model. I have a large poster size up here for you. And a copy of my PowerPoint presentation. Now, before I say anything, I do want to mention one thing, not sure if any of you watch Games of Thrones, but one thing that they always say is, winter is coming. Well, they may not be experiencing climate change, but we are, because winter never came.
They are, they're just in denial.
Yeah. So... I've got, yeah, okay, winter's coming today. I have a total of 9 slides, and here we are in slide 2. I'm going to cover the purpose, which Ms. Kyumjin talked about briefly. I'll show you where we are on the timeline for this project. I will give you some highlights from the workshops. I'm going to explain this draft conceptual model and talk about some of our existing tools that we have. And I will list some main policy issues to guide our discussion today. And I'm going to lay out some steps going forward. So as Ms. Kyumjin talked about, the purpose of this climate change adaptation project is to first understand what changes will happen and what tools we have to address those changes. And the project aims to engage with the public and discuss our options for adaptation in a transparent process. And we strive to implement adaptation, and we'd like to include some recommendations to the board, to the state board, if we deem necessary. So where are we? Back in mid-2014, last year, the state board gave us some direction to all the regions. Why don't you guys embark on this process, figure it out? That's pretty much what they said. So, following Patty's guidance and leadership, she said, well, let's have some public workshops. Let's do this. So the board had 2 public workshops, one in November in Barstow and one in January up here at Niktaua Community College. And so here we are today, right in the middle of the slide. And this is the part where we engage with the board, also with the public, and get some feedback on things that we heard and maybe figure out some steps forward. And then I'll talk about some of these other steps that are dashed further down in my presentation. I want to point out that we, as Region 6, may be the furthest along of all the regions, but some of the other regions have already done some things. Region 3, back in 2013, adopted low-impact development practices as requirements in some of their permits. In October of 2014, Region 8 conducted an informational workshop on the climate change issues. And they're dealing with a lot of imported water and the need to import more water from the Colorado River, which has a higher salinity. So they will have increasing TDS problems. In Region 5, a few months ago, back in March of 2015, held a panel-style workshop to inform their board and get some feedback from the public. Region 2, I want to mention, though they haven't had a formal workshop, did adopt some provisions in some of their permits to require wastewater agencies to regularly inspect their infrastructure and plan for future events. And that's pretty much it. We're kind of blazing the trail, as some folks may say. So, if you recall our November workshop that we had in Barstow and our South Lake Tahoe one, we had just over 100 people attend, which was great, really great. Both workshops had researchers present in the first half, and those researchers told us what they expect to see. No surprise, all the researchers agreed that we would see larger floods, the surface waters warming up all over the region, we're going to have longer dry spells, the precipitation will fall more as rain and less as snow, and our groundwater sources and our reservoirs will have less stored water in them over time. The second half of each workshop was a public brainstorming session where we broke out into small groups and we brainstormed over some issues, actually two questions. What policies and tools should the board have, and what steps should we move forward with to address climate change adaptation? We received more than 400 ideas at those workshops and the emails that were sent to me following that workshop. So what I did is I put in, not in Enclosure 1, but actually in Enclosure 2, are all the ideas that we received at the two workshops. I didn't enclose all the emails that I received, but what I did is I took all those emails, all the ideas that we received, and I synthesized and boiled them down to three main themes. And I put that in Enclosure 1. And Enclosure 1 is a matrix of all those ideas boiled down into simple phrases. And then to the right side of each of those ideas that we received, those main ideas, I listed the existing tools or actions that we have out there to address those. And we do have some gaps. So to understand the gaps that we have and the tools that we don't have, we need to understand everything that actually is in place and what it's doing today to address climate change. And so I created the... Yes?
Sorry. So in your Enclosure 1, in the very first column, you have numbers 1 through 4. What is that? What do those numbers mean?
Okay, the numbers correspond to what I lumped into under the main theme. So one is protecting resources and providing resiliency.
Thanks.
So all the ones were those ideas.
Right.
Okay. All right. So to understand the gaps, I put together this climate change conceptual model, which you can see here, everybody has. And the nice thing about this is we have three main changes. So there's larger floods, warmer waters, less snow, and what those changes would cause. What will the negative effects be? And then what tools or actions are out there today to address these? And when we did this exercise, we discovered, wow, we actually have quite a number of tools out there. But we also have some gaps. And the boxes in red identify regulations. And those are things that are either in permits or directly in our basin plan that require certain things. And these requirements are directly related to addressing a climate change effect. Let me give you one example. So if you go here to the bigger flood, and we have wetlands and floodplains are a negative effect of flooding. So what things are we doing to address these wetlands and floodplains? And some of the feedback that we got at the workshops were, try to restore these, try to protect these, because the floodplains and wetlands provide resiliency. And what we have is, in Tahoe, we have, in our basin plan, requirements that are prohibitions against disturbance in floodplains. And we also have requirements for mitigation. Now, in doing that, we identified that those requirements only exist in Tahoe and Truckee areas. We don't have them anywhere else. So we do have some questions to address some of those. So using the conceptual model, along with Enclosure 1, the matrix, We've identified some of these gaps and issues to help guide our discussion. And then on the item page 9-7, we list questions. So these questions are some more specific questions which are around these policy issues. And our discussion today, I will be embarking on this to gather your feedback and feedback from the public. But before I do that, what I want to do is go forward to the next slide and show you kind of where we want to go with this. What staff would like to do is take all the input that we received from you today and the public, put it together in a draft report later on this summer, circulate that for public review, get some input, and then bring back to the board in November some final recommendations. Now, the nice thing about that is it lines up perfectly with our scheduled triennial review. Wow, how did that happen? And if you remember, the triennial review is a list of all those items that our basin planning and TMDL unit basically leads, and all those projects that we want to tackle. And we use the board's input to help prioritize that. One of the highest priority projects that we've been working on is this bacteria water quality objectives project for our region. So the board can give us input on where, if anything, we should put on this list and maybe kick something else off or below the line. And then following that, a few months later, we do the workload, our annual priorities. So I'm going to go back now to the main policy issues, and I'm going to actually, Ms. Lori Kemper, our assistant executive officer, is going to help with this because, one, she's a great writer, she can, wants to do this, and before I go into the six questions that are listed here, the most important thing that I want to do is get some input, some general input from the board on what their ideas are and the biggest challenge or the most important thing that you would like us to address as part of this process. For example, is it dealing with these floodplain prohibitions? Or is it dealing with critical recharge areas? Or is it engaging with the disadvantaged communities? I don't know. What are kind of your highest priority issue to tackle?
All three.
So that was three for all, or is the chair going to call on us one by one?
Vice Chair, how would you like to handle this? I'm happy to serve as, you know, help facilitate, and it might be helpful because I've invited our two members of the public here for you to maybe hear their names and include them in this kind of brainstorming, because what we really had envisioned for the next, frankly, the next couple hours, if you are interested, because we do have all of these questions that are on in your green sheet, the six questions. I mean, I wanted to just spend, 10, 15 minutes on each question to really kind of see what everybody's ideas are or thoughts. So that was what we kind of had planned for the rest of the morning. This is all you have left on your agenda.
Okay, yes. We're going to do this in an orderly fashion.
Excellent.
You asked the question.
That sounds good. Most important actions. All three.
So that was floodplains. Well, that was expanded floodplain protection.
Well, this is just an issue, uh-huh, dealing with floodplains.
Okay, floodplains.
Recharge areas.
Recharge.
And DACs, disadvantaged communities.
And I see floodplains and recharge as being, in many cases, linked.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, sometimes it's the same place.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Mr. Jardine.
I have a quick question. How do you deal with local communities in the Tahoe Basin regarding development within the floodplain? I know we're looking at, Alpine County is looking at a 100-year flood mapping. And, and we've got several communities, but we actually purchased a Forest Service station that was
So, so Tahoe, as you heard in the previous presentation, there's no lack of process and there's no lack of regulations dealing with that. There are existing regulations at our agency, as well as TRPA, existing prohibitions. And so it's a very collaborative process, and what we've done, since a lot of these regulations have been on the books for decades, a lot of the local communities already know about them. And we engage with them on projects that they wish to go forward with. And there are public maps showing these floodplains and these wetlands out there, which they're called stream environment zones in Tahoe. Because the regulations on these stream environment zones have been around for decades, I believe, as a resident of the Tahoe Basin in the last 25 years, and whoever else has been here as longer than me, can really attest to those regulations are very well known in the sectors. And so anytime that there is proposed development in a floodplain, there are lots of public meetings, lots of public involvement, and most of the times those projects are highly contentious. And some of them don't go forward because of some of those issues.
Yeah, so I think floodplains, identifying them, and showing the tools to local communities, such as transferring development units from within the floodplain to outside of the floodplain. So I know a lot of communities are behind the curve. We're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
But that's just us. And recharge, yeah. I have to agree, that's a major issue for us, because we not only have aquifer, but we have
Well, and as you know, the Water Board does not have land use authority. And so when the Water Board has this floodplain prohibition, that's kind of a de facto land use authority. But in the Tahoe Basin, the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency has land use authority, and so that's where we work together to make sure that all of our regulations, permits, processes align.
And I just want to add, because I think it's obviously in Tahoe, the local land use regulations are consistent with our basic plan. That makes life a lot easier. And there are transfer development rules and all these things that aren't in our basic plan but are in TRPA's plans. But the other example that would probably apply to the rest of our region would be the example of the Truckee River prohibition. So you're dealing with Placer County and Nevada County. Those two counties don't have floodplain prohibitions. They don't have ordinances, limiting development in these areas. So now we have a basin plan that has prohibitions. The counties know about them, and mostly what the counties do, I think what you said, Don, is that most of the counties, just like our current basin plan, identifies floodplains as important things to map and to try to prevent development in and protect and preserve, but then they go ahead and allow things to happen, right? I mean, that's essentially the way it works, right? So then in our region right now, in Placer and Nevada County along the Truckee, we have these prohibitions that say you can't develop in these areas. So the county will tell us if there's projects coming along, or we get the CEQA documents and we comment. But often the county will tell people at the counter as well. They'll say, for a private home developer, the Water Board's not going to let you build a house in the floodplain. So they punt it to us. This is why we're bringing up this question, because this is where we are now in the Placer and Nevada County area along the Truckee corridor, in the town of Truckee even. So if we were to expand our prohibition to other parts of our region, we end up being the bad guys for the local governments, because local governments don't have the regulations in place. And so there is a process, and obviously there were a lot of years, I mean, those prohibitions have been in place in Truckee, along the Truckee Corridor since 1980. And you can drive down the Truckee River Corridor and see houses that were probably built in the floodplain after 1980. And that was because it took a while for the local governments to let us know these things were being proposed, and for us to inform the landowner that they weren't allowed to do that. And so some things happened, and some things we've taken enforcement actions when we've seen more recent egregious encroachments, you know, because some of the houses got built out of the floodplain, but then they started to expand their, adding fill to expand their yard and retaining walls, and we've taken enforcement action on those things. So that's what we're bringing to you is the concept of, do we want to expand our authority into other parts of our region where we currently don't have those kinds of authorities? And I was noticing the excerpt within your package that has the floodplain, or has a discussion about wetlands and floodplain management. There, it's been a recommendation that we do that, that we consider expanding that authority since probably 1980 in our basin plan, but we have not had direction from the board to do that, so we haven't embarked on adding prohibitions to other parts of our region. But now that we're facing climate change and we see how those prohibitions, I think, have been effective at really creating resiliency, it may be time to, make a bold move or decide, to talk about that. So that's why we're talking about it today.
Seems to me that floodplains are strongly related to wetlands, and we do have prohibitions against the destruction of wetlands.
It's not really a prohibition. We have policy that says no net loss. And under the Corps regulations and under the governor's and the presidential orders on no net loss, and under the current Corps guidelines, we do the avoid, minimize, mitigate. So we try as hard as we can to avoid, but then we reduce the impact as much as possible. A lot of negotiation. But ultimately, if someone says, no, I want my clubhouse in the floodplain or in the wetland, or I want my road or golf cart path or whatever, then we say, well, then you're going to mitigate. And then they go mitigate somewhere, and
which
may or may not be as successful as we'd all hope. So that's the current process in the rest of our region. See, in Truckee and in Tahoe, we have the ability to say, no, we don't even allow them to be in the wetland in Tahoe or Truckee if they're a Walmart. If they're a private commercial development or a private residential, we only have exemptions for public health and safety and recreation.
So we should towards
environmental restoration.
Doing this region-wide, I think. Floodplains, okay. Wetlands, recharge.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's all one thing.
Right.
So, Mr. Sandell, what...
When do I get my turn?
I just want to quickly explain this. So the water quality cert, the board issues the 401 water quality certification, that's what Ms. Kemper was talking about. It requires compensatory mitigation, but there is no 1.5 to 1 specific requirement, nor is there a prohibition. And so that's region-wide.
Although the ratio thing, I do want to point out that the notion of compensatory mitigation is being expanded in the Corps' regulations. So, and we do use their regulations. So what Toby Tyler and Jan Zimmerman does under those guidelines is it actually now does promote increased ratios and looking more at functions and values. So the federal regulations are stronger now related to the ratios. So I think that our 1.5 to 1 is frankly antiquated in our basin plan, and a lot of places we require more than 1.5 to 1, and we do that now under the current federal regulations. There are opportunities, though, to potentially expand where we want to require mitigation because we're using the Corps' definition for wetlands. So if we wanted to include riparian forests or more like what we have in Tahoe Stream Environment Zones, that would require an expansion of the current existing regulations in terms of what areas we'd be looking at, to do mitigation for. So.
Mr. Jardine, did you have other ideas?
Some other tools, like conservation easements where they get a tax break on certain lands.
Okay.
But that's, I know Dr. Lund wants to talk there.
Yeah. We can keep circling. It's nice too to kind of get ideas and then just keep keep coming back around to get another chance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that you were done. Okay.
Dr. Horn.
Thank you. So I approach this from a different direction, trying to think of. I mean, there are a zillion moving parts here and a lot of detail. And the only way my brain can deal with it is to try to develop a strategy so that I understand what the highest priorities are. Okay, I'll just walk you through my thought process. So, you know, our mission is to protect water quality. So in terms of surface water, we want to reduce the discharges that might be caused by climate change. But in terms of protecting groundwater, I mean, there we have both actually a function for protecting quality and quantity because of our ability to influence groundwater recharge. So, and then I started coming up, okay, how might we rank the various actions that we could do in terms of next steps? And actually, the thing that I think, so I started off with like an XY, and then it was like, oh no, it's three dimensions. Oh no, it's four dimensions. Okay, so I can't picture that anymore. And I got up to five dimensions. And of those, the one that I think is really most important is whether the negative effect of climate change is a short-term effect or a permanent effect. And if you look at the permanent effect, that's the lower tier here, where losing the ability of aquifers to store water. I mean, the more water we store underground, the more water we're storing that isn't subject to evaporation, as in reservoirs, right? So it's better if we can keep water stored underground. That's better. So we don't want to lose aquifer capacity. So protecting groundwater recharge areas and groundwater quality, I think, is really important because those impacts are really hard. Now, you know, floods are bad and they cost people money, but it's a short-term, generally, it's more of a short-term thing. And, that short-term, long-term axis, I think, is probably the most critical factor. Then the other four factors that I came up with was, you know, what's the biggest threat to water quality? Thinking of the chart last night on the underground storage tanks, you know, looking at arsenic being something that was really important and benzene being less important in terms of occasions. What's the easiest to change? So if we have a policy, we need to modify our policy, how easy it is to change. Another factor is the political controversy, so how difficult, politically controversial it might be to change. And the cost doing it. So those would be the five factors, I would think, for, you know, arranging the different things we could do. And there might be other things, but that's what came to my mind. So I guess I would like to see our options kind of ordered along those, according to those criteria, so we could start sorting, developing a sense of what are the most highest priority things to do. What do we do first? What can wait? You know, so some of the things, you know, might be really easy to do, but it is really very small in terms of adapting to climate change. So maybe that's a lower priority than doing something that's harder, but is more important for adapting to climate change. Then the other thing is identifying areas we need more information about. Now, I know in hydrology, when hydrogeologists look at mass movement, most, like, I mean, the numbers I'm pulling out of the air, so, you know, but it's surprising, like, 90% of the mass movement happens in the 100-year storms. You know, you tend to think that there's all this stuff coming down, but it's really these really big storm events that move the most stuff. Now, is that stuff we need to worry about? Is that mostly big boulders? Or is, I mean, I don't know how that relates to the fine sediment that we're concerned about. So, you know, our regulations are now written around, you know, 20-year, one-hour events. Is that the best way to write the regulation in terms of water quality? I don't know. And, I mean, that's just an example of something where, of identifying things where bringing in some scientists to educate us about, you know, really what the biggest threats to water quality are in terms of the anticipated effects of climate change, it might be helpful to us. And I guess that's all I'll say for now.
Yes. Humphrey.
I'll try not to repeat what's been said before, with which I generally agree. But I am struck by the fact that if you look at attachment one, although there may be some gaps, there's really a very rich body of either tools or regulations or approaches or things that we've commenced that relate to these things. And so one of the things that I'm wondering is whether or not one of the useful ways to approach this would be to look at filling the gaps by looking at the way our policies are arranged. Can they be refigured? Can they overlap, or do they overlap? And if they do not, can they be tweaked a little so that they overlap to cover all of these issues? I think that one of the things that should be a real priority for us is finding a way to coordinate what we're doing with all of these other agencies and affected groups so that they become implementers of our policies as well as ourselves, and so that our policies reflect the considered judgment of other agencies. This is a global problem, and we really need to try to make sure that we're not approaching it in a siloed manner, so that, God forbid, our policies or our procedures would work at cross purposes to somebody else's while we're trying to approach this question. We need to work on our ability to be nimble, along with everybody else. This is change requires change, and if we find ourselves in a position where it's difficult for us to change, it's going to be difficult for us to do appropriate things in response to this situation. And my last thought is that in sitting here earlier this morning, is we've done some really remarkable work along with a lot of other people in the Lake Tahoe Basin and also in the Truckee area. And we need to really look at that as a model for the region as a whole. So we've done a lot of the work that we may need to look at throughout the region, so we don't have to start over. We don't have to go say, well, you know, what would be a way to approach this, because we know the answer to that. It is going to be difficult, perhaps, politically, everything's difficult, to export some of these policies and to export prohibitions. But at least we know that they work. We have examples that we can lead people to. We know the value of coordinating and collaborating. And so as we go forward with this, my hope is that the spirit that brought 100 people together to give us 400 ideas will keep those 100 people together, ask those 100 people to recruit 100 more people to help us to go forward and implement what we're trying to do, so that we're just not the water board doing water board stuff, we're the water board as a part of a large structure of people in our region that are responding to these issues.
Thank you. I concur with Mr. Humphrey's comments, but from my personal point of view, I would also like to emphasize the protection of groundwater recharge capabilities.
Excellent. So we kind of covered the floodplain wetland recharge area. That's a common.
Yeah, that was that first question on this.
Yes. One of the things maybe we could follow up on a little is the concept of that Amy brought up about infiltration. The 21-hour storm, that refers to a requirement in the Tahoe and Truckee area to infiltrate the stormwater run. And that's really not so much to deal with these big flood events in the river. I mean, it is a little bit to try to shave off the hydrology and the flow to the river, but it was also determined to be a good way to get water generated off the pavement into the ground to protect it, really, from the water quality perspective, too, to not collect a lot of pollutants. So it's a more of a, it's all related, but it's a little different than the floodplain, per se, protection. I guess one of the things to maybe talk about a little more beyond the floodplain wetland thing is just the concept of low-impact development and the concept of stormwater as a resource. And I think we've been beginning to have these conversations, especially in the desert, but even here, that it's how do we integrate and have individuals use the stormwater generated on their property instead of just feeling like it's something to get rid of. And so I don't know if folks have any ideas or thoughts on that topic.
Well, while you're thinking about it, let me just explain to you what's already out there. So the state board has a state construction permit that has low impact development as guidelines. They're not requirements. Region 3 adopted their permits and required that all their projects, all their construction projects, implement the LID principles. What we have is, in our basin plan, we have narrative that talks about BMPs and the sort of low-impact development guidelines, but we don't have any requirements specifically stating thou shalt require this. We do have the volume requirements of the for the infiltration, and that's down here, and that addresses the change that we're going to expect getting more precipitation as rain and less as snow to try to capture that. And we have that in Tahoe to require that volume.
If I could also add another thing that's in law. Senator Pavley passed a law last year asking local governments, to your question, Don, about local governments, to prepare stormwater plans into the scheme of stormwater as a resource as opposed to a pollutant regarding dry wells, construction of dry wells, and areas to infiltrate stormwater. Locals are required to prepare those plans by, I think, sometime mid next year, and the state water board has been releasing protocols. That's probably a tool, another tool, where locals can put these ideas in.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the specific question that's in your green sheet, I think it's number 2 on that page, about should we expand our requirements similar to what Region 3 did, as well as consider adopting general permits for areas outside of Tahoe, but also areas that aren't covered by the current MPDS stormwater program. So just to bring, this is a little introduction to an issue that we've been talking about for a while, but we haven't brought it to you, and that is that US EPA in 1992 determined that stormwater was a pollutant that could be regulated. Obviously, here in the Lahontan region, we've been regulating stormwater, specifically the Tahoe and Truckee, since the 80s because we knew it was the source of pollution to Lake Tahoe. But in 92 was when the regulations came in that there would be construction stormwater permits and municipal stormwater permits and industrial stormwater permits. those permits that now State Board has adopted for the state of California do not cover many portions of our region where the Army Corps of Engineers has determined there are no waters of the U.S. And that is the entire...
That might change soon, depending on the EPA rule on waters of the U.S.
It actually, the stuff that's on the street won't actually change us, change it at all in our region. That does expand the definition slightly, but it's still not...
Let Gina McCarthy hear you say that.
Yeah. So I guess so this is something that was interesting. We were talking about taking our statewide construction stormwater permit that State Board adopted and bringing it to the Water Board to adopt those waste discharge requirements instead of the federal program and just apply it to waters of the state. So that's something that we've been considering. And I think Patty's recent conversations with the local governments in the Mojave watershed, which currently is a water of the U.S., but the whole Antelope Valley is not. Lancaster, Palmdale is completely out of that program. So in those areas, the locals have said, and their biggest frustration has been Sacramento adopts these permits and requires specific BMPs that don't seem to make a difference in the desert, primarily, you know, because of these design standards, and they get these big rainstorm events that a typical BMP maybe doesn't do any good for, and the functions and values of those waters are different than the Sacramento River. There's fish they're worried about that don't go belly up, and in the desert they're worried about recharge. And so there may be an opportunity for us to use our state authorities to tailor a program that makes more sense in some of our desert regions. So that's what we're thinking about.
I agree with all of that. And let me point out one thing that we haven't talked about yet, which I think we're talking about, but we just brought it up.
Yeah.
I think we need to look at stormwater, perhaps has to be looked at as an asset, not as a pollutant.
Yes.
But also with that comes the standards that we are currently applying to groundwater recharge, which is part and parcel of stormwater, really. We may have to be looking at allowing more change in aquifer storage quality, allowing more change, more degradation now, but go for volume and then wellhead treatment as necessary to clean up what we have allowed to be stored, because in this kind of drought situation, we just need the water. The fact that it may have something in it that we don't really like, we can deal with it later. And I think we need to start leaning in that direction for both of those avenues toward recharge.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you.
That's very good point.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all the ideas here sound good, of course. I'm just feeling uncomfortable. I'm not ready to say, yes, go forth, right? Because I want us to be strategic about this, mm-hmm. about deciding which are the things that are the most important to have. So I was actually hoping to shift the dialogue a little more to defining our strategy as opposed to the details of what we're going to do. I mean, I would love to have LID, require LID throughout our whole region. Is that the most important thing we should be? Is that where we should be putting our energy right now? I don't know that. And so I guess that's where I was hoping this conversation would go, is that we start framing what our strategy is, how we're going to go about developing a strategy for approaching our policies to climate change.
I think that's what we're hoping to achieve with this report that's yet to be written. Is to at least start with what are the key ideas and what are the ones that the board members prefer more than others, so that we can kind of write, because we have 400 ideas. We're distilling them down. This is the next boiling point down to some ideas, and with that will be the strategy.
Right, but this feels to me like it's bottom up. It's saying, okay, we have this idea, LID, that sounds good. We have this idea, floodplain protection, that sounds good, as opposed to, okay, is this effective? Is this a gap we really need to address? Is this costly? Is this politically controversial? Is this, maybe those aren't the right criteria for developing a strategy. I'm just throwing those out as ideas that have occurred to me.
Well, and you're right. I mean, in terms of strategy, you start with what are the problems you're trying to solve, you know. And I think we've jumped a little bit based on what we heard from the public that, there is development going on that may be impeding or preventing infiltration or recharge, or we're losing wetlands, or people have seen these things, whether they read about it or they drive by them. So those are some of the problems that kind of heard from folks. And we're trying to look forward in terms of, being in a better place 5 years from now.
I think it's hard, in my mind, it's somewhat difficult to develop a strategy for a set of unknown tasks. So I tend to think that what we need to do is to take a look at all of these suggestions, number one. See how many of them are already inside of things that we're doing within our three-year work plan. See how many of them might not directly be inside that plan but could be folded in fairly easily because they are sort of part of something that we're already doing, even though it's not the directly identified work task. So that would tell us what we would need to think about how to add. And then I think if we're already doing it, the question is, do we want to rearrange our priorities to do more of it or to do more of it sooner? And if we're not already doing that, do we need to plug it in favor of something else? I think that's when you sort of get to the question of what is the strategy for following through with these things. Assuming that the 400 ideas are 400 discrete ideas, and I know they're not, because I know they're clusterable. We're not going to be able to do 400 discrete plans. And so I think we need to really see where those ideas fit into what we do. See how many of those 400 ideas we might have to farm out. There's some of them we might not be able to do much directly on at all. And so we need a strategy for how do we get somebody else to do the 208 of the 400 that aren't ours, but are ours and somebody else's. And so that's sort of what I would hope to see is more of a distillation of where does the input from the workshops fit into what we're already doing as opposed to what we need to think about doing in addition or instead.
So the input that I'm hearing with Dr. Horn's idea on the strategy and then everybody else's feedback so far, I think this is... I think this is exactly the type of input that we need. We didn't come here with specific recommendations. And as you know, as you saw on this guy, I didn't say what those recommendations are. It could be, strategy could be a big part of that. It really is at the discretion of the board. What does the board want to do with this? And the dialogue that we're getting is great. We just want some dialogue, some input to figure out what we need to do next. And part of it could be answering some of these questions. Part of it could be figuring out the strategy. So I think what I'm hearing is really great feedback.
And one other thought I had, something Lori said. We do have a situation where we have tried, and I think it's appropriate, to craft our policies to reflect local conditions within the region. But I think there comes a point where you have to recognize that climate change is region-wide. And so if we're going to have climate change policies, I think we have to think carefully about how we want to make them region-wide, because although the climate change impacts may not fall equally on the region, they fall on the region as a whole. And so it might mean that this is an opportunity or a nudge to have us look at that relationship between localized requirements or localized approaches and more region-wide things. The distinction, climate change, I think, blurs the distinction between Lake Tahoe and everywhere else and makes the policies that maybe were once thought to be really Lake Tahoe appropriate only, maybe they're not Lake Tahoe appropriate only anymore because the resource is being impacted and is becoming scarcer throughout the region.
Excuse me, Lori, we're going to have to leave. We have other commitments, but we greatly appreciate being part of this. We just found out about it this morning from Alan, and we're thrilled about it. We would like to be part of the discussion, have been in the past at your workshops, and would like to continue. Please let the public know. The public is interested. You see that.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be sending, definitely.
Thank you very much.
And we definitely will have our next step, our report out for public comment, too, so before the board begins.
Thank you so much.
All right, thanks for coming. Good, Peter, about expanding Tahoe region-wide concepts.
So, as the staff is going through this, developing the report, or whatever your next steps are, I don't have, can you put that slide up?
Certainly, there.
Yeah, okay, so as you're working towards the November 15, it would be useful to have a column or pull out areas, so there's areas where kind of three buckets of information. There are things where we know what the problem is, we have the science that so we understand what we need to do, and we have the tools. So, check. And then there's the bucket of these are things that are out of our control and we can't do anything about it. You know, like we can't do anything about temperature increase. And there are a lot of things, there were a lot of great ideas that came out of these workshops, but they're not things that we have that we have authority over, or, you know, whatever. So those we can put aside. Then there's the middle area where we need more information. And it may be that the information is out there, we just don't know it, and so it would be a question of bringing in scientists or whoever would be the right people to help us figure out the best direction to go. There might be areas where we need more data, we need more basic science done, and so to start developing a list of those areas where we need more information before we can really figure out what the next steps are. I mean, so the issue of the stormwater recharge, I mean, I was comparing the approach used in the Tahoe Basin with what's in the general stormwater permit. And they're completely different approaches. I mean, one is the 20-year one-hour flood, the other uses the 85th percentile. I have no way of judging which approach works better. And maybe you guys already know the answer to that. But, you know, so that's an example of, I don't want to get into the weeds on that particular example, but that's an example of where more information might be helpful. So to pull out where we need more information, and also pull out the gaps, of course. I mean, the gaps are what we're driving at.
Okay. Excellent.
That's a good segue to one of the other areas, just the related relationship to research and monitoring. I think we heard that from a lot of the public, that notion of, there are things we know and we can do something about, and then there are the things that we don't have enough information about. Part of that's because we're not monitoring, we're not actually identifying, we're not measuring change over time, we're not seeing the trend. So there's a lot of things that may be going on in our region that we don't have well understood. So that's a potential area where, again, we don't have a lot of control over that because we have limited budget, but that may be one of the areas where we make a recommendation to the state board or the legislature about the importance of
or we start proposing funding streams to pay for the monitoring.
Yeah.
Incorporating that into our regulations.
Mm-hmm. And I would hope that we've identified in these items that are in handout number one or whatever, attachment number one, the things that exist outside of ourselves that we need to tap into or bring online with everybody else. So part of your third bucket might be out there somewhere, and we need to lead the charge to bring that into a larger, under a larger umbrella that is the regional response to climate change. I mean, we're the only agency that is this regional defined. But so that means that we have the opportunity to be the agency that sort of leads the parade and tries to recruit people into the parade to come up with a regional approach. And that's going to be really tricky and really ticklish. But one of the things that I'm seeing emerge is that every time we have a meeting, we have somebody who comes and says, your staff, your people, your executive officer, great leadership. So that's obviously a resource that we have that's maybe not reflected on the list of tools that's in the handout, but it's a really strong resource we have, and that's a resource that we need to think consciously of how we're going to employ that resource, our staff credibility in the region, as well as their leadership capacity to gather momentum to deal with this problem as a whole.
Excellent. So if you look at the six questions, just to follow Mr. Dias's idea to go down this systematically, I got feedback from question one. I got some feedback from question two with some other sort of contextual comments on that. And then we got some overarching comments on question three. Does anybody have anything else to add on question two and three before we maybe jump down to question four? I'm not seeing hands go up, so I think we could move on to question four, and it's kind of a different little issue. Deals with our monitoring. Back on, I don't have the page right in front of me, but back on 9-5 or 4 or 5, I listed out the four swamp objectives, and none of those objectives mentions the words climate change in there. And about 95% of our very small region-wide budget for the swamp is spent on objective one, which is gathering the existing data from our surface water bodies on the water quality, and the existing state of the water quality. And the reason why we have to spend the lion's share of our small budget on that is that we are one of the few regions who don't have a lot of dischargers in those remote areas. And so we need to understand what the water quality is. And through that, we found a lot of things. We've identified a lot of our mercury impairments in some of these reservoirs. We've identified a lot of bacteria problems. And then some other issues. So it's money very well spent, but it is a very small budget, and we don't directly address climate change. Though a lot of this data, for all intents and purposes, can be used in assessing what climate change is.
What would you add to address climate change? What we're doing now, which seems to be we're recording a lot of data, which is influenced by climate change.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we could do is we could modify one or more of those objectives and actually get the words climate change in there.
Okay, that's
in some fashion.
Paper word change.
Yes.
All you need to do is refocus the analysis a little bit, and you would have a lot of climate change information right there in front of you.
The other, exactly, you're right, and I think some of the things that Patty and I were talking with Alan yesterday actually about the state board kind of stalling out on the biological objectives program. So you've heard some presentations from Tom Sook before, and obviously we've collected some macroinvertebrate data and biological data, but right now it is not something we're collecting as part of SWAMP. It really is our current budget is focused on the chemistry because of the money. But there's also potential opportunity to, again, kind of reflect, tearing off of what Amy says, maybe engaging with our research about what are some of the priorities. Maybe it's time to shift from the chemistry and the chemical concentrations of things and focus on the biological integrity. That maybe that's the right thing to do. I don't know that it is, but I'm just...
But would that just be a matter of readjusting the same amount of money to focus on something else about changing the budget?
Right.
And
that's
so where do you identify, for example, a mercury impairment, which is not going to change over time? You could look at it every 10 years and
right.
be fine.
Right.
You could change that focus to a biologic something or other.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, and I know that you know the difference between when these were sort of identified and where we are today too is that there's been money spent on these rapid assessment protocols, and I know Peter Pumphrey brought up some of the citizen monitoring that's going on in the Sierra Nevada group. But there are some new tools to potentially employ that would help us score our watersheds, you know, to help us get a better sense of our inventory of what we have and what looks like it's impaired from a different perspective than the current perspective.
One quick thing I wanted to point out is the one change relative to this that we would see are the warming of the waters. And some of the negative effects are these algal blooms, invasive species, and stressed aquatic systems. So that's where the biological assessments come in. And although the SWAMP program really is focused on just water quality, the priorities could be refocused to deal with some more of these things.
Yeah, that's exactly where I was going to go. I mean, so in my brain is going in two different directions.
That's good.
So one is, I mean, I like the idea of SWAMP monitoring the biota, because that's kind of a holistic, this is the result of all of the factors. But we also need to understand the drivers of what is causing changes in the surface water. And what I don't know is, I mean, I know USGS has gauges all over the place. Are they also, I mean, so what data do we have on the drivers, the increase in temperature of surface waters, the flow and all that? I know they've got flow data, but what other drivers there might be that would be affecting cyanobacteria, the other harmful algal blooms, the ability of invasive species to survive, to become established and reproduce in our waters. And expanding SWAMP, I mean, who else is out there? It makes sense to me to expand SWAMP to pull in information, existing information about the drivers that are affecting water quality, and also some of these other things that are the results of the warmer water.
I think that's a great idea.
That's a great idea, and I think Gloria's capturing it. Wanted to... Alan has been asking me several times to speak, so I'll let him talk.
Well, I wanted to just speak to Amy's strategic desires, I guess, a little bit, and that I think that some of the things that have been mentioned in here would play into an overall strategic plan that fits well with our existing authorities, with precedents that have been set throughout the state and in other, you know, respects. So we would just be following on that where we have some gaps in our region, like, for instance, with the stormwater programs to encompass more of the desert regions, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. that's really just working with the locals to help them understand better how to protect the resource and to do reasonable things to do that. Currently, it's unregulated, so whatever goes. And in terms of the monitoring, which is kind of really why I stepped up here, I've worked with State Board on various things and haven't gotten very far with it, so maybe the regional approach is going to be more desirable. Now, some of the regions do have robust programs like monitoring along the coast where they've got large dischargers to pull in and stuff. And I would just, my model for how I would prefer to see monitoring done in the state of California with regard to water quality and quantity would be to have the dischargers be monitoring their effluents, the discharges that come out of their pipes, and have the state be monitoring the quality of the ambient waters as we do in the swamp program, but to a greater degree such that we would, perhaps collect money from various dischargers, that we would run the program, and we would decide where in the region the funds are best spent, and that we would have professional managers to run the databases, to figure out where the data gaps are, to help us fill that in over time. And we have big players like LADWP that currently don't provide anything to us, but they take all the water and they dry up all the wetlands. And they're just not been brought into the to the game that we need to do to adapt as a state of California in our region. So that's just a little bit of kind of how I see things. This whole thing of stormwater as a resource, it seems like, the light bulb's finally come on. You can drink that stuff, but we don't want it all polluted either. And one way of filtering it is run it through the ground, put it through the soil filter, and put it back in the aquifers. And that's something that hasn't really been pushed to any great degree. We fought. I worked with the State Water Resource Control Board to get those post-construction best management requirements into our construction activity stormwater permit statewide. The Building Industry Association sued us, and we prevailed because the judge said, basically, if the water board can't require during the time of development that the post-construction controls be put in, when else could they require it? So we fought that good battle and we won, but we don't have that in certain parts of our region. We don't have any requirements to do any infiltration, and certainly not to purify anything that's being infiltrated. So, thank you.
Thank you.
That's a
good point.
So back to the question four. Any other ideas on the swamp objectives and monitoring? Any other thoughts than some of the ones that we've captured so far?
Well, I support Alan's points about more funding for swamp.
Figure out a way to integrate the discharger data. I feel like we haven't done that as well as even some other regions have of trying to bring the dischargers in to the regional monitoring approach.
And having a regional monitoring approach that is scientifically sound, that gives us, that's not just, a spot here, a spot there, but is developing a holistic picture of water quality in the region.
And also just going throughout, not to disregard also NGO information, others. It's not just the dischargers, but there are a lot of people out there that do modeling as the citizen monitoring. You see, taking interest in that.
Well, especially that gets people more engaged in what's going on in their watershed, more interested, the more time that they're spending. And some of these things that we were talking about, looking more at the biology, it seems like that's something that citizen groups can do more readily than some of the more chemical testing. They can go out and see there's a lot of algae bloom, and they can be monitoring in that way much easier than taking samples or invasive species or the bugs.
Excellent. Thank you, Lou. So I think we could maybe go on to question five.
I think what we've been doing is adaptive management. I don't think we need to discuss it specifically.
Good. We're a good example, huh?
We are. We're all adaptive management. Yeah. But I don't think we need to list a bunch of stuff that we've already been dealing with all day. I agree.
All right.
Well, I mean, in terms of what we've learned in Tahoe TMDL and, you know, in terms of thinking of sort of What is the periodicity that would be appropriate for revisiting text?
Exactly. Sure. That's what I was aiming for there, is using the Tahoe TMDL management system as the model for adaptive management, where all the protocols are written down, the annual assessments, the review, the public input, all of that. And so the question is, does the board desire a similar process to be written down, documented, to deal with climate change adaptation as things happen?
Why wouldn't we?
Well, somebody's got to write it.
It's a priority of it.
Just have to adapt.
Just adapt, okay. Just do it.
Go ahead.
I would just suggest that, you know, we have this really more sophisticated model of what we're doing in Lake Tahoe.
Sure.
And I think it would be really helpful to me, at least, if someone were to sit down and say, here are the things that we think we can and ought to export, and to what degree, from what we're doing to either to the region as a whole or to other places. I don't see any reason. I'd rather be told the reasons why we can't do the same level of inquiry that we're doing in Lake Tahoe throughout the region. And I know there are questions of cost and other things, but I'd rather know why we can't do that than have a discussion of why we should.
Good.
It's just a way of figuring out how to do it, and that's where the strategy part comes into play.
Good. This is the feedback I was hoping to get.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. So that sounds like I'm just seeing head nods. Great.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, we don't necessarily, you know, be able to cross all the T's and dot all the I's in an adaptive management plan for climate change.
Oh,
but
no.
We need to have that. We need to have the placeholder for that.
Yes.
That is part of how we're dealing with.
Yes.
And part of that is that when you talked about drivers, you know, that whole the conceptual model notion, too, of really being able to periodically be able to go back and look, what do we know about the drivers? What do we know about our information? You know, it's setting up that framework to be able to do those check-ins, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And adjust based on those.
Great feedback. Perfect. So this brings me to question six. I'm just kind of shifting gears a little bit. And what are your ideas on bringing recommendations to the state board? And it could be anywhere from, okay, we don't have this authority, we would like this authority, or we think state board should tackle this statewide issue. Just giving ideas.
Well, I do have an idea. My idea is that we visit this question when we've completed our analysis of what it is that we want to do, and we come up to grips with what we can't do, either because we lack authority or we lack money or we lack whatever, and then look at this question then. I'm done.
Simple. Got it. Got it.
5 seconds.
Yes.
Well, it's great to know that the board feels the same way. That's great feedback. I think Mr. Larson really paved the way with his item last night and getting great feedback. And, of course, you guys were on a roll today giving us great feedback. Mm-hmm. So this is excellent. So
And if there's any other, I mean, I have a few other questions.
Yeah, we've got a few before I can just kind of wrap up, summarize. Okay, why don't you,
I have one other thing I want to throw out, which is I would propose that we form a board subcommittee to work with the staff on this report over the next half a year, whatever, and I volunteer to be on that subcommittee. And if nobody else wants to be on the committee, that's fine. And if there are more than two people, well, then maybe we have to figure out a different way to do it. But I just am expressing an interest in working with the staff on developing.
Great suggestion.
And it might have and you might want to consider whether or not you can break it down into smaller issue
sure.
clusters so that you can have more than one small group and not one small group would have to be responsible for the whole shooting match.
Well,
that could happen after we get to this.
Is it, yeah, that could are be any other board members interested?
Well, it depends on what it is that we're being asked to do.
Well,
and so if we're being asked to do everything, I'm probably less interested in doing everything than I might be interested in doing something.
So the staff has to read your mind to find out what you're interested in?
They do not have to do that.
Like
I'll talk to the staff and I'll deal with that off meeting.
It seems like an iterative approach, as you said, Peter, maybe when we bring back the staff. I mean, in other words, just like we've done with some when we've done our priorities and we said, these are some of the new policies or permits we're working on, and the board could then volunteer to say,
yeah.
Hey, I'm interested in that thing.
Right.
So
exactly.
So it's sort of like post us putting together a report and recommendations, there may be interest to have some additional subcommittees. I know Amy, during our briefing, had suggested she was interested in just this next step of pulling this stuff together into a report, and Doug kind of covered this in terms of the draft report for public review out this summer. We're actually planning to compile our report recommendations and circulate it internally first with staff, so there would be an opportunity, say, if board members were interested to even be part of that process, and then we would put this report out on the street to get a wide public review and comments, and then we'd bring it back to you. So that's kind of our timeline for this summer and fall, and Amy was interested in participating in that. So as she said, she could do that by herself or with help from another person if they're interested. So, and then subsequent to that, we can talk about additional subcommittees once people see some of those ideas.
Does that sound favorable that we, at least as staff, know we have ideas, put some more meat on the chicken bones to
yes,
flesh it out a bit more of what are the core areas and then report back to the board and everyone about, so that you could say, I'm more interested, let's say, in monitoring, I'm more interested in groundwater recharge or
mm-hmm.
stormwater or everything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
That works.
Okay. Lori, did you want to get a couple of closing thoughts on some of those other questions?
I think Peter covered some of this earlier about, you know, what actions build on our strengths. These are some other open-ended questions I had in case we didn't cover things today. I think we covered a lot of this, the notion of, but if these inspire other ideas, mm-hmm. we'll take them. Like, what actions build on our strengths? What actions are likely to succeed or be effective? That gets to what Amy talked about, what's sort of easiest to do. And then just kind of wrapping up, an opportunity for you to share any concerns you may have, you know, your fears, any ideas on how to approach those things that, you know, you might be feeling a little apprehensive about launching. Because when we change, we usually are leaving something else behind, something we were comfortable with. So.
Okay, I'd actually, I will say, so this was something, is there anyone who's when I worked for a different organization, there was a tendency, people were anxious to act. So the saying was, you know, we're human beings, we're not human doings. So it's like you see a problem, you know, we have a tendency to just want to go out and do it and fix it. And sometimes it's better to sit and think about really what the most effective thing to do is before you go out and do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be my only fear, is that mm-hmm. in our excitement and enthusiasm to address this issue, that we not rush out because we might be doing things that we later learn weren't the best ideas or the best use of our energy.
That's, I think, a really excellent point. My concern sitting here is that this is really ambitious, the time frame on the next steps. depending, of course, on what we mean by report and recommendation. And the report and recommendations that by November may just be the strategy discussion as we then develop the actual actions. And I kind of hope that that's what it is, because I think that so much of our success is going to depend on our ability to maximize our own resources, but also to form a network throughout the region to deal with what we think are appropriate actions. And I think what we're going to find is that a lot of the actions that we can take for climate change, we're already taking, and we just need to tweak them and make them a little bit more directly responsive to that. So the bucket that has other people have to do this or other people have to help us is probably going to have to be a really big bucket. And so our discussion really in November may be focused a lot on how do we get these other guys in the tent? If we have the tools, how do we get them, you know, to the people? How do we, that kind of stuff.
And I, just to add on to that, I think that's really, really important, because we often get a lot of pushback from local agencies or some of the people that we're putting the responsibility on to implement these things, because it costs money, because it costs time, because it's maybe not what they want to do, you know, for other reasons. And so it's, we don't necessarily have all the authority that we sometimes think that we do. And so it's going to be really important in order to get these things done to figure out as next steps, who do we bring in? How do we all get on the same page and understand their priorities too? Because it may change what we want to do first or can do first.
I think when we get to November, I think that one of the things that we might give consideration to is going back out to this, in this workshop format, reporting out what we got and sort of convening these local or more local summits about here's what we found, here's what we think we might be able to help do, but here's the stuff that we need to talk about as a group, whether it's in the Mojave area, whether it's up here, whether it's in the central eastern Sierra, the more north, whatever, however that shakes itself out. But I think that we need to go take what we found and really invite people to come talk to us about it, and talk to us about their roles in working together.
And we may have to show up at their
most definitely
meetings too.
Most definitely.
Great feedback.
You sound tired, Doug.
It's anticipatory retirement.
just do it. Attitude.
Just do it.
So yeah, this, you know, and I have to apologize. This item kind of came together rather quickly, because it took quite a while to synthesize all the 400 ideas.
Oh yeah, that's a massive
into something that we could actually get on one piece of paper. To figure out what to do next, and I hope it seems like it was helpful to do all this so that we could figure out these next steps. So let me just kind of summarize a little bit to make sure we all understand what was said today and where we're going forward on this. So I presented some of these ideas, even though I didn't dive into any of those details. But presented what some of our existing tools we have to address some of these concerns and suggestions. And then we identified some of the gaps that we have and had some questions that we thought would help guide the board's input on this. And through that, we discovered that it appears it may be the board's directions to maybe sit back and look more holistically at this process and the strategy about getting to the end game on this. And that would probably involve, as Mr. Pumphrey suggested, some more workshops to engage with some of these stakeholders and really roll up our sleeves with everybody on that. And the report and the recommendations that may come forward in November may largely focus on that strategy and that process. And although we did dive into some of the details, some of those things are not recommendations right now, but those are ideas that sounds like the board would like us to really present, to talk about with the stakeholders in the public. And we may need to go and join at some of their meetings to really show that we are reaching out, trying to get them engaged. Because as the board has said many times before we started on these workshops, that you really want to make this a transparent process with the public. And so that's going to take time. It's going to take time, and so that's what I see in these recommendations. It's not final recommendations on floodplain prohibitions here or there. We're not there yet. But the ideas, some of the ideas that that we presented, we can formulate some of those into some packages that we could then take to the public in these small group brainstorming sessions, which seem to work really well, especially with the board members as small group facilitators. You guys did a great job. And, of course, our great staff helped on that, too. So that's where I see us going in November. But before that, you'll probably get to see our internal draft report. Because as you can see, and Alan has just been one staff who's had one of many staff who's had lots of ideas on this to help us out. And so that's why we do want to engage internally, engage with our staff, engage with you before we even get something out.
I wonder if maybe we could do one other thing. I don't know what summer means in terms of the calendar, but when we're together again in July, let's say, maybe you could give us a kind of just an update of where things are if you have found these smaller clusters of issues, so that if members of the board say, oh, you know, that's something that I'm really interested in and I'd like to work with you on that, we can identify that earlier rather than having to wait until November.
I'm happy to do that. And the meeting will be here.
Yes.
In this room. So.
Right in this very place.
I'll be standing right here wearing the same thing.
In June? No, July.
July.
Okay.
I meant in July.
July.
Yes.
July. It's June, it's down the road.
I won't be there in June.
Okay.
Because I'll be working on this. Just kidding. Okay, excellent. Thank you very much. Great feedback. And everybody else for the input. So. Great.
Thank you.
Oh, I did. Any questions? I had that. That was my ninth slide, my token ninth slide.
Any questions? Thank you very much, and thank you especially for consolidating all those 400 questions and boiling it down to something we can work with.
Oh my gosh, you should have seen. It was quite fun. There were lots of different ways to do it, and I ended up doing the old trusted, the old way. I put them all out, and I cut them individually, and then sorted them, and then distilled them into main themes.
Wow.
That my room, if somebody opened a window or turned a fan on, that would not have been good. But not. You should see all those papers, those pieces of paper. Don't come in here. Oh, and I just one thing. I wanted to point out that State Board has been asking us on all of our stuff, all the things. They are very curious on this. So Patty's been forwarding all this stuff to them. They're very appreciative, very eager to hear what we come up with, and they don't have this conceptual model yet, but I think that really distills everything down into something that people can really see, and the general public have to send kudos to our esteemed admin staff who took my crazy idea and actually put it into something that is legible in some nice colors. So they really, you know, kudos to them.
If I could add to this, at the end of the month I'll be going to a gathering of all the regional boards and the state board, and this is on the agenda about what everyone is doing. And there's a big desire on the part of not just our region, but all region boards, to ask the state board if they would do a similar process. Mm-hmm. You know, because a lot of the issues are really within the purview of the state board and their authority. So it's possible that some of the things we do will help inform the state board to do something similar at the state level.
Is there anything else to discuss? Okay, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.